Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of The Damage Report. I am John Adrola. It is JR Wednesday.
Oh, it's about time you get the right thing. It's always off the top. First thing needs to go. This is not Wednesday. It's not The Damage Report. It is JR Wednesday, and this happens to be The Damage Report. It also happens to be 10 o'clock on in Los Angeles.
It is.
All these things are secondary information.
I suppose. Now, primary information would be what we're going to be talking about the show today, because there's a lot. In just a little bit, we're going to give you a couple updates on sort of the future over the next couple of weeks of our wait to see the actual Mueller report, because people seem to have forgotten that no one has seen it so far other than Barr and possibly some people in the DOJ. Then we're going to move on. We've got Adrian Lawrence going to be joining us to break down the developments yesterday in the Justice Smollett case. We've got the NRA's strategy on fighting back against people who don't want kids to be massacred. We've got the worst instance of, I would say, aggressive, like shoving people's economic privilege in your face from CNBC that I can remember in recent history. It was one of the most offensive tweets I've ever seen in my life. We'll break that down. Maybe I'm exaggerating. We'll see. We've got the author of Dying of Whiteness. That's Jonathan Metzl. He's going to be joining us to talk about how racial resentment leads white Americans to support policies that are literally killing them. And then in the E block, maybe my favorite congressional, not testimony, but I guess short speech from a politician coming from AOC on the Green New Deal. It is unbelievable, and so we're going to be breaking that down at the end as well. So buckle up, JR.
Oh, I'm ready.
And you, dear viewers. Okay, let's jump into it. Donald Trump, very happy about the Barr summary of the Mueller report. Obviously, we don't have the Mueller report. We don't know what's in it, but we do have William Barr's sort of selections, his interpretation of what's in it. And Donald Trump loving it so far. Here is what he said when asked about the review.
Mueller report said, the Mueller report was great. It could not have been better. It said no obstruction, no collusion. It could not have been better.
It does not exonerate you, sir. It does not exonerate you.
Let me just tell you exactly what my message is. The Republican Party will soon be known as the party of health care.
You watch.
Or if not that, at least the party of taking away our health care, because he said that on the same day that they announced that they want to take away health insurance from 30 million Americans. So sort of important. We broke that down on yesterday's show. Go back and watch that. But there were a couple of interesting things there. I mean, his reaction. It was great. Could not have been better. Bear in mind, of course, that ABC has reported that as of when he said that, neither Trump nor his attorneys had even been briefed on it, let alone actually looked at the report. The president's comments pertain to a summary of the report written by his handpicked attorney general, Bill Barr.
I'm going to venture to say that he didn't even read the summary
I don't think he read the full summary. There was a little bit of the summary I didn't even read necessarily. Skin bits. I have a feeling he didn't read any of it. And so, look, very happy. Couldn't have been better. Complete exoneration. Even though even the summary by William Barr specifically says does not exonerate him. I believe there that statement is more pertaining to obstruction of justice, but it specifically says does not exonerate. But that hasn't stopped everyone from saying it exonerates him, because you know what? It's more fun. It's more dramatic. Everything's changing so fast, even though some things are not necessarily changing. And so he's very happy. Yeah. Interesting though, sources behind the scenes say that when he was initially briefed on this, not so happy necessarily. So a source who was with Trump at Mar-a-Lago over the weekend told Axios's Elena Treen that Trump was, quote, initially frustrated with Barr over the line saying the president hadn't been exonerated on obstruction of justice. The media chyrons and outlets all jumped on that as a sign of more to come, the case not being tied up with a bow, which is why he's pushing the, quote, complete and total exoneration line. His initial reaction was angry over the coverage that line got. So, as is so often the case, it is just projection. So, he's pissed off that it says he's not totally exonerated, so he is going out saying he's totally exonerated, because up is down, you know, left is right, all of that.
But that's always worked for him in the past. As you know, first he was mad at Jeff Sessions for recusing himself and not doing what his attorney general is supposed to do. He's got William Barr in as the head of the department, right? Mm-hmm. So he didn't completely toe the line either. He needs him to absolutely come forward and set the stage, which he's done enough for him already, by the way, in just in the way that he's handled it so far. But he needs 100%, not 99%, because there's still something he's worried about, still within whatever else is going on. I still need that to get my point across. So the thing is, it doesn't really need that. for someone who didn't read even the summary, he knows that the majority of his followers also aren't going to read it, aren't going to pay attention to anything except for what he tells them to pay attention to. That's how he operates. Mm-hmm. So he was frustrated that he didn't have any help. But then he remembered. He goes, wait a second. I can just say whatever, and they'll believe me then.
Exactly,
let me get out there and do what I needed Barr to do. And he's doing that now. And I think it's working to an extent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the thing that frustrates me a lot about this is people aren't worried about what was in or out of the report or what the findings were. It's just more about people, and this is on all parts of the argument, from progressives to libs to pseudo-progressives to conservatives, is I was right.
Mm-hmm.
This has become about each individual person's assessment mm-hmm. about what they said before and what they think and how right they are.
Yeah.
Not about whether or not the Trump campaign had anything to do with Russia and conspiracy or any kind of agenda he's followed since. It's about I'm right.
Mm-hmm.
It's about me.
Yeah.
Apologize to me.
Commentary is 90% ego.
Yeah.
And that is why I'm very confident saying I have never been right. Except on climate change. I think I'm pretty much right on that. Other than that, always wrong. But watch anyway, because it's fun. Yeah, I agree. And look, what I think buttresses your argument is, again, almost no one has actually seen the report.
Yeah.
Now, it's entirely possible that Barr's summary is 100% reflective of what's actually in the report. That in his four pages, only 98 words of which actually come from the Mueller report, that it is an actual accurate reflection, and that we will learn nothing new that will actually change our conclusions. That's 100% true. I personally think the idea that Barr like directly lied and contradicted the actual spirit of the report, that seems unlikely. I don't think that that's probably going to be the case. But I'm not stupid, and I'm not going to pretend that William Barr wasn't expressly chosen to do what Jeff Sessions wouldn't do and protect Donald Trump, not necessarily from being impeached, but from consequences and stuff getting out. And there's reason to believe that that's going to happen. I mean, William Barr looked at Mueller saying, we're not going to make a determination on obstruction of justice or not. And Barr says, no obstruction. Well, Barr wrote a 19-page letter, five times longer last year, saying that Trump had not committed obstruction of justice. This is before he had access to anything in the Mueller report. So before he knew any of the facts, he had already made the determination that there could not be obstruction of justice in this case. So, I mean, look, it might be that Trump didn't obstruct justice. But I'm not going to pretend that Barr saying it is some like, I think he looked at the evidence and I think he weighed things and then he just came down in a way that benefited Donald Trump, the guy who just chose him for the position.
And if you go back to my point about how people need to make sure that they're right, if you go back to, again, his 19-page thing where he said before and he didn't actually have any evidence or even a report in front of him, he can't be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We're in an atmosphere where you can't be wrong. You can't change what you said before because now you're a hypocrite, you're a rhino, or whatever else they want to call you.
Yeah.
So now you have to stay consistent despite whatever it is that's in front of
you. Yeah, yeah. By the way, anyone who can't admit when they're wrong and claims that they're always right, they're liars, don't follow them. Anyway, important future information though. So where do we go from here? When are we actually going to get access to the sum total of all that was found in the 700 days of the Mueller investigation? Well, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said Tuesday that Attorney General William Barr told him he would send the special counsel Robert Mueller's final report on the Russia investigation to the White House before the public sees it, in case it wants to claim executive privilege over any parts. Graham, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, also said Barr told him it would take weeks, not months, to make a version of Mueller's final report public. So two important pieces of information there. One, hypothetically, within weeks, we will have access to something like the Mueller report. So if you're curious, as few people seem to still be, what's actually in the report, then in a few weeks we might know. But Trump is going to get access to it first. And if he wants to redact portions, if he wants to change portions, he can do that and he'll have time to do that.
And they won't bring that up. They won't say it publicly. The way they're saying, you know, it was found, no collusion, no obstruction. They'll say that for the next few weeks, not months. They'll say it every day, so that's drilled in your head. So no matter what comes out after, whatever else is redacted and then somewhat halfway given to the public, you still remember the original thing they said.
Yeah.
It's all about conditioning your brain to hear what they wanted to hear.
Yeah. And by the way, we've known that this is coming. So Trump's lead defense lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, told Business Insider last year that Trump's team would want a chance to review the Mueller report before it's made public to correct any inaccuracies. And Rudy Giuliani specifically said, as a matter of fairness, they should show it to you so we can correct it if they're wrong. They're not God after all. They could be wrong. So that's not even like factual inaccuracies. That's wrong.
So say someone who's against this whole thing, because the people that have come out and said, okay, Mueller found out and we're all gung-ho on it. Oh, Mueller concluded that there was no obstruction, and that, which he didn't, and that there was no collusion.
Which then, he apparently did.
Right. So then if people who are in opposition to Trump say, you know what, there could be inaccuracies. He's probably wrong. I should get a chance to look at it so I could tell you how wrong he is. You know what people in the administration would say? Mm-hmm. Oh, you just are hell-bent on keeping this president from having any kind of success. You're going to look in the face of the facts and say it's inaccurate?
Yeah.
But Rudy Giuliani can say that because in case there's a 2% part of it that don't agree with what Trump wants it to say, he can fix it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's okay on this side.
Again, I think it's entirely possible that Barr's summary is an accurate reflection of what will be in the actual report. Mm-hmm. And that we're not going to get the Mueller report. It turns out, oh, wait, he did conclude that there was collusion. I don't think that that's going to happen. But in his summary, the little bit that we got from the actual report, he doesn't say we didn't find anything that was super shady or we didn't find anything that implied that something was going on. He says we don't have enough to actually make the case that they colluded, that there was a conspiracy and that Trump should be taken down, which is fine. If it's not there to be found, then they're not going to find it and it apparently didn't happen. But we do still need to know specifically what was going on because there's a lot that we've learned over the past 2 years that was not addressed in that 4-page letter. People have a right to know that. So anyway, we might find out in a few weeks if there's any of the report that doesn't have a big black Sharpie applied to it. So we'll see.
Age old Republican line, if you didn't do anything wrong, you have nothing to hide.
Exactly. And Mitch McConnell already voted earlier this week, or stopped a motion, I should say, to get the full report. And again, Donald Trump, like the executive, we just showed you the video. He said it was perfect, couldn't have been better. Well, then you don't need to improve it with a marker, do you? Anyway, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, Adrian Lawrence will be joining us. Jussie Smollett, apparently walking free. Let's talk about that after that.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Anyone who has claimed at any point along this process that they knew what was going to end up happening in the case of Jussie Smollett is a liar, okay? Because stuff is evolving fast. And as of yesterday, all charges have been dropped against him. And joining us now to help break this down and where we go from here, attorney and contributor to both TYT and AM to DM, Adrian Lawrence. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. We could really use your expertise on this. So Chicago prosecutors have dropped all charges against him. And although they say that they still believe that he is guilty of something at the very least, what do you make of this?
You know what? This is one of those circumstances where you have to look at that prosecutor's office and also that state. And the thing is, unfortunately, Illinois, it's number one in public corruption situations. It is. And for the entire country, they had 1,731 federal public corruption convictions since 1976. They lead the way. And so to see something like this go down, it's not really that shocking. The fact is they had sufficient evidence. They had a grand jury indictment. 16 felony counts. It's just someone very powerful made a phone call, and now Jesse Smollett's essentially paid $10,000 to get out of jail.
So that part as well is very interesting. The $10,000, where does that actually go? And is this a normal thing that happens in cases like this? Not that there are any cases like this.
Yeah, this is actually kind of special. For him to forfeit the $10,000 bond, hey man, like it's just, I think that that's because that's why the state's attorney's office, when they said, considering all the facts and that he's going to forfeit the $10,000 bond, we're not going to proceed with this case anymore. It just seems like he's getting paid for it and it'll stay within the court system.
Interesting. I've seen some people, so Jesse Smollett has put out a statement saying that he maintains his innocence. I had seen in advance of that people saying that he should probably just count his blessings and not say anything. Do you think that he might attempt to take this further, that he might attempt to sue the police department or someone in relation to the experience he went through?
Not to jump in, but no, I don't think he will, because he doesn't want to be in a situation where he has to prove that there's no validity to those allegations against him. It definitely seems like it's a $10,000 payment and keep it pushing. The thing that really kind of really resonates with me is the fact that he did get a 16-count felony disorderly conduct indictment that carries 1 to 3 years in prison apiece. Wow. So he was facing 16 to 48 years in prison.
Jesus.
The reality is, whoever maybe made a phone call, so I speculate, it really realized that this could end up being a true miscarriage of justice. But unfortunately, that is how our system works. And if the people in the city of Chicago, if that was their conclusion as members of the jury, then that is the system and how it should work. No one should be making phone calls to get people out of jail or out of charges. But at the same time, I do appreciate the fact that 16-count felony indictment facing up to 48 years in prison is a little excessive.
Adrian, it's JR. Okay, so for people who don't understand how it works, the prosecutors dropped all charges, exonerated, closed the case, shut it down, never going to be seen or heard from again. And then apparently because a powerful person, influential person made a phone call. How often does this happen when, under normal circumstances, under basic judicial circumstances, does this happen where a prosecutor will drop charges? What could happen within a case that would make them, after seeing all this evidence and after all these charges being brought forward, make them say, you know what, we're going to drop it, and it is legitimate?
I am just speculating that mm-hmm. someone made a phone call. But in situations where a prosecutor may have a legit case against someone and there is no outside influence to get them to drop it, it might be a number of factors. For instance, maybe the charges against that individual are not that significant, or the individual has actually rehabilitated themselves. And in the interest of justice, it might be best to let them move on with their lives. Or maybe that information or that individual is providing information that is being very useful and has been helpful to other prosecutions. There are a lot of reasons that prosecutors have the discretion to not pursue charges. The problem is when prosecutors exercise that discretion to the benefit of only a certain member of society or to the detriment of only certain defendants is when we have the problem.
Yeah, I'd also like to get your reaction to a couple of the reactions to the news of yesterday. There are a lot of people who reacted very strongly to finding out that there would not be any pursuit of charges or jail time or anything like that. Fox News was all about it yesterday. So first of all, though, Mayor Rahm Emanuel has been going around on TV, and he had this to say.
Did this all in the name of self-promotion. And he used the laws of the hate crime legislation that all of us collectively over years have put on the books to stand up to be the values that embody what we believe in. This is a whitewash of justice.
So do you agree with the overall idea that this is a whitewash of justice? And I'm also curious, that particular terminology to me sort of stood out as maybe carefully selected words. What do you think about that?
Oh, I definitely think the words were carefully selected, and I do not know what to think of his using the term necessarily whitewash. But I would almost assume it's in the context of the quid pro quo, I give up 10 grand and you let me go. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what I would think in terms of maybe the prosecutor's idea of justice in that instance, but I do not know. I do understand Rahm Emanuel's his rage with this situation. because essentially, you know, there are a lot of hate crimes going on, and he undermined it for all of the individuals and all of the marginalized members of society who the hate crimes were essentially created as legislation and passed in states to stop the things that would be going on in terms of racial injustice, whether it's religious or even gender hate crimes. And that's so important to a lot of us. So essentially, if the allegations were true, Jesse Smollett set us all back. So there's a lot of fury and rage, especially when you see a lot of hate crimes currently going down and the rise and the increase given the Trump administration and his actions allegedly having been played out just so he could get an increase in his Fox salary or be able to stay on his show for longer.
Yeah.
So essentially the motives, and they don't measure up with the sacrifice that we've all now had with hate crimes being undermined.
And I want to talk about one other sort of, I would say, category of reactions to this. People on Fox News, Fox Business, I saw James Woods. These are people who are saying that this breaks their heart because, as you've been pointing out, people who are really targets of hate crimes might be questioned in the future. Of course, I would say that all of these people saying that have never, ever cared about hate crimes before in their life. But for instance, Stuart Varney said that the judicial system has been, in his words, raped. And they're pushing for some sort of federal investigation, something along those lines. Do you believe that that is likely?
As I had mentioned before, Illinois, they're the number one city in public corruption in terms of federal prosecutions of public corruption at the state level. Mm-hmm. So pretty much the federal government has been the key player in terms of oversight for the corruption that exists at the state level there. And so essentially we need to look to the federal government to right the wrongs done by the state. And hey, there's a situation here where the FBI is not willing to comment on the investigation for Jesse Smollett when it comes to him mailing himself a allegedly forged hate crime letter. And the situation with the federal government would mean federal mail fraud. And that comes with up to 20 years of prison, up to $250,000. But again, the FBI won't comment on where that stands. The thing is we really need a check on the system for the system to operate correctly as it should. The problem also is that certain people have been getting passes forever, which is why we hear from these sudden commentators who give a damn about hate crimes. But the thing is, it's like it's everybody really loses looking at this entire situation, because we do know that there has been serious years of public corruption, minorities and disenfranchised individuals being unfairly penalized or having members of law enforcement not be held accountable for misconduct. But at the same time, too, we know allegedly Jesse Smollett really set everyone back. So I think it really does tear at our strings on both ends in that our system is very broken.
Well, Adrienne Lawrence, we want to thank you for joining us on the show today and breaking all this down.
Thanks.
We're going to take a short break. We come back, more to get to. So yesterday I was on Twitter and I got mad, which is true every day, but I got mad for a very specific reason. It was I saw this tweet by CNBC, let's bring this up, where they show here's a budget breakdown of a couple that makes $500,000 a year and still feels average. And they break it down there. And so I want to break it down a little bit more and focus on a few things, because you might react as I do and say $500,000 a year and you feel average. Okay, so Sam Dogan of Financial Samurai said, this one couple shared their story. And I decided to anonymously highlight their reported expenses with a focus on why they end up feeling average, even though they're such high earners. So first of all, a few of the big standout expenses right off the bat, quote unquote expenses. As you can see, they both max out their 401k plan each year and are working on paying down student loan debt. But even though they qualify as upper class, after taxes, fixed costs, childcare, and discretionary expenses, there's only $7,300 left each year to go towards other savings goals, investment accounts, or retirement funds, which again, they have already maxed out for both of them, their traditional retirement accounts. So that 401k contribution, by the way, that is $36,000 per year for them. They also pay property taxes on their $1.5 million home of $20,000 a year. Both of those things are over the poverty level in income by themselves. Now look, I got JR here. JR, you've probably looked at houses. $1.5 million house in LA is not necessarily a very nice house, but in most parts of the country, that's like a mansion.
Yeah,
to
you
me.
Can. When I visited friends back in the Detroit area, way outside Detroit area, actually, now that many of them live. And I asked him how much houses were costing. I mean, my friend's doing great. And he told me how much his extremely large 2-acre property house cost him. And you couldn't get a box here for that much, mm-hmm. right? So I get it. So other parts, so in certain parts of the country, certain things cost a certain amount. But honestly, even in L.A., $1.5 million for a house, you enjoy that place. Mm-hmm. You do. You're not worried about it. You're not like thinking, oh, man, street cleaning is going to come by, so I can't park my car on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 8 to 10. Like, there's things that where you relax and you move on and you can put things in your house. You can have room for your kid to play in. You can mm-hmm. have room where they hang out in, too. There's things that you actually still get for $1.5 million, even in L.A.,
yes, I think in general.
No, you're not living in a mansion, no, but you're living comfortably.
I have seen houses on my street, which is 2 blocks from the highway and 2 blocks from projects, for over $1 million, and they are obviously houses that would have to be demolished and be rebuilt, mm-hmm. just because it's land yeah. in L.A. Yeah. Doesn't mean you're getting—I went on Zillow, which don't do that. I went on Zillow— and the advertisements for many of these houses, they were being very clear. Oh, you're gonna have to tear all this down. Yes, sure. You're gonna pay $750,000, but you're gonna have to pay it down. So okay, so that's the housing. Yeah. Let's talk about other things though. So 3 vacations a year, $18,000. I understand you're gonna think that I'm lying. I don't think me and my family took a vacation of any amount in the first 16 years of my life. No one in my family has ever been on a $6,000 vacation, and they want to take them 3 times a year and feel average. $6,000 can take you anywhere. You will see, you will go on a tour across China, you will go throughout the South Seas, and you will visit all of the greatest cities of Europe in 1 year, and you'll feel average. And then you'll feel average the next year when you do it in 3 other places. And average the next year when you do it in 3 other places. What are you talking
about? The headline was obviously incorrect with the CNBC studying this. Their point was to say, this is a case study in not understanding your perspective. Mm-hmm. Or not seeing anything past your own point of view. So you're thinking this is average. Again, this is a very similar story. The first time I was on an airplane, I was flying to go visit college. Because mm-hmm. I had already accepted without going to visit because I couldn't go visit. So yeah. I was like, man, this is nice. Wonder what this is like, going to college. So yeah. So taking your kids on flights all over the world and doing this average, it's not average.
Yeah, it's not average at all. And I just want to run really fast through these. Because again, I want people to understand, the CNBC wrote this. This is not parody. This isn't The Onion. This is the perspective that not just his family is coming from. And again, I'm not trying to demonize the family. I'm trying to demonize our entire country. That they just think that this is totally normal. So car payment, $9,600 a year. That's to have a BMW 5 Series and a Toyota Land Cruiser. I got news for you. If you have a BMW anything, you're not average, okay? Let alone a new 5 Series. Children's lessons, sports, piano, violin, academics, $12,000 a year. That's $1,000 a month for lessons. And as people have pointed out, the kids probably are pretty young if you are paying, it was $42,000 a year in child care. That's a lot of money. Implies that these are kids who are having around the clock help. Charity, Feed the Children, college alumni, $18,000. So I'm glad that you included Feed the Children because I'm pretty sure college alumni means that you're giving money to your school. So that is sort of charity, I guess, but you're giving a on the line of poverty amount of money every year in charity and then saying, I don't know where it goes. Where would you want it to go after that? You've already given $18,000 in charity. Miscellaneous, because something always comes up, $10,000. What is coming up? A new business idea? A boat? Did a boat come up? A new Harley. It just came up my driveway. $10,000. And what's left after all of that? $7,300 after maxing out your 401k, going on 3 trips around the world, having a super nice house, a super nice car, giving a ton of money to charity, your kids know kung fu. $7,300. I feel average.
Scraping the bottom of the barrel. What are we going to do with the $7,300? I don't know, honey. Guess we'll just throw it on the pile.
Yeah, what was the percentage of American families that would be wiped out financially by a $450 surprise
yeah.
thing? You know how many you can do of that in $7,300? You got a calculator. It's not hard to calculate. This is not average, man. And God, some people, including in media, CNBC's media, 100% out of touch.
Yeah, I mean, straight up, you know, and no one is, I'm sorry. This is where the narrative will go wrong. They're saying, everyone's so mad at someone who makes any money. No, we're only upset when you keep talking about how, woe is me, I only have all of these things. Yeah. I have an idea. Shut up.
Yeah. And by the way, in CNBC, when they're not doing profiles of families like this, they're advocating for lower taxes on families like this. Yeah. Now, yeah, sure, that would help out their family. Instead of $7,300 in feeling average, they'll have $25,000 in feeling average. But it doesn't fix the problems of the country. Okay, we are going to take a break. We come back. Author Jonathan Metzl is going to be joining us. He wrote the book Dying of Whiteness. And we're going to break it down after this. We have been wondering for many years, what is the matter with Kansas? And a new book sheds some light on that. We're joined now by Jonathan Metzl, Director of Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University, and author of Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Very glad to have you here and talk about this subject. So, Dying of Whiteness, what is that about?
Well, it's basically a book about how the politics that claim to make America great again, and particularly white America great again, end up, if you just study the kind of aggregate effects of what's happening on the ground, end up being risk factors that make working class lives, and particularly working class white lives in some instances, harder, sicker, and shorter. I'm somebody who's from the Midwest. I grew up in Kansas City. I live in Tennessee. And basically what I did was just started tracking what happens if you live in a state where you block the Affordable Care Act and don't allow for the expansion of services, or you let a lot of guns in, or you have massive tax cuts that help really wealthy people but end up cutting roads, bridges, and schools to everyday people. And it turns out that those policies themselves are as dangerous to working class people as are man-made risk factors like asbestos or secondhand smoke. And the irony of the book is that the greatest drop in life expectancy in some of those instances were among the white working class voters who were supporting the GOP politics in the first place.
So that was a great preview of some of the specific policies. So let's talk about what you found. So you spent years going to these areas of the country and talking with people. And what are some of your explanations as to why people continue to support the policies that in your words are literally killing them?
Well, a good part of it had to do with underlying anxieties, not just about race or racism, but this idea that basically minorities and immigrants were going to come and take away resources that were due to working class people, very often working class white people. I'll give you one example. I did about 2 or 3 years of research in Tennessee around the time that the state was debating whether or not to adopt the Affordable Care Act and the resultant Medicaid expansion. And I did focus groups with people who basically told me that even though they might have benefited, some people I spoke with were incredibly medically ill. And they told me, even though this program might help us, we're going to vote against it in a way, or support politicians that do, because, and this is a quote, we don't want our tax dollars going to what they said were Mexicans and welfare queens. And so part of it was just this idea of racial resentment. The problem with that logic was when they started, I mean, we're all kind of connected in this world, right? And so the minute they started defunding the healthcare system in the state, in effect, their health suffered as well. And one of the most shocking findings I found in the book was that blocking the expansion in Tennessee ended up costing the average white person in the state about 3 weeks of life expectancy. And so there was this trade-off where basically people were telling me, we don't want those services going to other people other than ourselves, you know, lazy minorities, stereotypes like that. But it ended up boomeranging and hurting them as well.
So one of the most interesting things is that, so you're giving examples of how racial resentment can lead to these outcomes in particular states, but that you're not saying that it necessarily says anything on the individual level about feelings of personal, individual level racism. So how do you differentiate between those two things?
That's exactly right. In other words, I make very clear in the book that probably a minority of people I spoke with expressed some kind of overt racism. And most of the people, I have to say, were not thinking about that. They weren't racist as far as I could tell. The issue, the big risk factor, it was about the policies, not the people. In other words, if you elected a politician whose policies were based in, for example, taking a lot of resources to try to block immigration in your state, taking away a lot of money that was going to pay for infrastructure and taking that money and using it for tax cuts for wealthy people and defunding, you know, infrastructure, the schools that your kids attended, factors like that. So part of what I argue in the book is that these policies were based in a kind of underlying anxiety about race in America. And the risk factor wasn't whether or not you yourself had that attitude. It was whether you live in a state that had those policies that ended up affecting your health. And I think probably the most tragic part of my research for me was these were disastrous consequences. I also studied Kansas, for example, where people rallied around this massive tax cut that defunded infrastructure across the state, and it collapsed the state. It lost all of its credit rating and factors like that. But instead of saying, gosh, what's the matter with Kansas? We don't want to replicate that. All of these disastrous policies ended up becoming the framework for policies that are now being furthered at the national level by the Trump administration. And so, in a way, these were the canaries in the coal mine for nationalized policies.
So one final question I think is important to ask you. So how do we fix this?
Well, part of what I argue, you know, people ask me when I wrote this book, what are we going to do to change people's, Trump voters' minds? And, you know, I don't want to go change people's minds. That wasn't my goal. I did come away from this project thinking that actually conservative working class voters should be asking more of their politicians. In other words, part of it is to say change has to come from within. I think it's fair to say I'm a Republican, but also I want better health care. I want better roads. I want better schools. And that promise isn't being delivered. So part of this is about the demand. You know, what conservative voters are asking for from their elected officials. And the other part I learned is just there's a lot of messaging that I think that Democratic candidates need to pay attention to if they want to reach people in America's heartland, that these topics that they're wading into, Medicare for all or gun control, things like that, there are long histories. And so part of what I do in the book is I say there's a long history here. And if you want a message in middle America, you better pay attention to the debates you're stepping into the middle of.
Yeah, and both that messaging and also the long history. This is not a new thing, obviously, as you point out in the book, more reasons why people need to take a look at this so they understand not just how we got here, but where we might go from here. And
that's
so, Jonathan,
exactly right.
I want to thank you for joining us. The book is Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. Thank you for joining us today on The Damage Report.
Anytime, thanks so much.
We're going to take a quick break. We come back, AOC delivers an address on the Green New Deal on the floor of Congress, and it is one of my favorite speeches from a politician ever. We're going to show you why after this. Yesterday in Congress, we had the debate on the Green New Deal, and we got to see two approaches to whether we are going to do something about the single greatest threat facing our civilization and our species. On the one hand, you had Republicans showing photos of Luke Skywalker riding tauntauns and telling you the solution to climate change is to have more babies. And at some point, Ronald Reagan was riding a velociraptor. And then on the other hand, you had AOC saying this.
The concern of the environment as an elitist concern. 1 year ago, I was waitressing in a taco shop in downtown Manhattan. I just got health insurance for the first time a month ago. This is not an elitist issue. This is a quality of life issue. You want to tell people that their concern and their desire for clean air and clean water is elitist? Tell that to the kids in the South Bronx, which are suffering from the highest rates of childhood asthma in the country. Tell that to the families in Flint, whose kids have their blood is ascending in lead levels. Their brains are damaged for the rest of their lives. Call them elitist. You're telling them that those kids are trying to get on a plane to Davos? People are dying. They are dying. And the response across the other side of the aisle is to introduce an amendment 5 minutes before a hearing in a markup. This is serious. This should not be a partisan issue. This is about our constituents and all of our lives. Iowa, Nebraska, broad swaths of the Midwest are drowning right now, underwater. Farms, towns that will never be recovered and never come back. And we're here and people are more concerned about helping oil companies than helping their own families? I don't think so. I don't think so. This is about our lives. This is about American lives. And it should not be partisan. Science should not be partisan. We are facing a national crisis. And if we do not ascend to that crisis, if we do not ascend to the levels in which we were threatened at the Great Depression, when we were threatened in World War II, if we do not ascend to those levels, if we tell the American public that we are more willing to invest and bail out big banks than we are willing to invest in our farmers and our urban families, then I don't know what we're here doing. I don't know what we're here doing.
I mean, look, there's more to it, and you should watch all of it. There's another segment where she talks about how people say, oh, how are you going to pay for this? And she talks about how much we're going to end up paying, breaks down the cost argument and the fallacies around that so perfectly. I loved everything that she said there, and everything she said there was true. It is still, people still act as if it's just Al Gore flying around. That's who cares about climate change.
Talking heads on Fox News, political pundits, conservative politicians, anybody who's been obsessed with AOC for the past few months and mock how stupid she is, young, inexperienced, and high, head in the clouds that you keep saying that she is, play that.
Yeah.
Play her entire thing, and then you break down. Laura Ingraham, on your show, play that and talk about how stupid she is. Mm-hmm. Hey, talk about how she has things prepared for her and other people are feeding her information, Brian Kilmeade. Go on there and talk about how, hey, you know what? Someone fed that to her. Someone said that to her, didn't they? Tell me how she read that from a piece of paper. Were those prepared remarks?
Nope.
From the podium with one of those stupid sticks that look like, one of those stupid microphones look like sticks in your pocket? Mm-hmm. Was that prepared and put together as a political statement to try and convince people of something that isn't real?
Yeah.
Tell me how that's not authentic and how that's not the reality. And you know what? Answer the question. Find out if you're willing to say to those kids that are dying and have different levels of asthma and actually have health problems that you don't care about how they're elitist. Answer the question. They're going to ignore this part, but I guarantee you heard it because you're obsessed with everything else that she says.
Yeah, there was no teleprompter there. That was her, authentic, passionate, and informed on the issue. She goes on to say on Twitter, 3,000 Americans died in Hurricane Maria. The Midwest is drowning as we speak. Hundreds of Flint families were pumped with poisoned water, and our water infrastructure is imperiled across the country. GOP thinks this is a joke. They choose to laugh and delay. We choose to lead. And yeah, so they're printing out memes. They're spending your taxpayer dollars to print memes instead of actually addressing these problems, these environmental issues that are not a joke. And they're not a problem for 75 years from now. And we just talked about earlier this week, or might have been last week, air pollution already kills millions of people across the world every single year. That's already the fires, the flooding, all of that. That is not a problem for someday. It's not for 75 years from now. The 12-year thing that we talk about, that's not when it becomes a problem. That's the sort of window we have to do something about it. It is a problem today. We are flooding today. We are on fire today. So I'm glad that she has the urgency needed. And by the way, look at how she's pitched when she delivers those remarks that have gone wild across the internet because of how passionate and authentic they are. She was described as flipping out by the New York Post. Yeah. And as Mimi Rocha says, women flip out, but men have passion, determination, and strength, yeah, which is what I see here from AOC. So again, as you were pointing out, the lies and ridiculous characterizations from people like Laura Ingraham, she still has to deal with that, yeah, even at her greatest moment. Thank you so much for joining us. Always good to
times.
Have you here. It wouldn't be JR Wednesdays without you. I don't think we're contractually allowed to call it that without you.
No, you know, yeah. Wednesdays can't even exist.
Nope, we skipped the Thursday. Okay, thank you everybody for watching. We'll be back tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.